The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Supposed to be focusing on the discourse, if you want to call it a discourse, that's part of the problem, beginning with chapter 8, verse 12. But as I mentioned before, I do want to make sure we don't forget, you know, whatever comes in between the passages that we're going to be focusing on. And in this particular case, I think it's especially important to see the latter portions of chapter 8 in the context of the whole section that includes chapters 7 and 8. There is a strong coherence in these two chapters viewed together. And I want to spend a little bit of time talking about how they are in fact put together. So let's talk about the literary structure of these two chapters. And you may, when I tell you how difficult it is to identify a structure here, you may begin to wonder whether there's really that much coherence, but there is. I mean, they really belong together. It's just that it's very difficult to come up with an outline of the two chapters that everybody would be happy with. And in fact, if you look at the way that different commentators to deal with it, it'll become very clear to you that it's just not obvious what is the best way of identifying the flow of the material. And part of the reason, again, is that you do not have a long discourse here. Even what appears to be discourse is said in the context of a dialogue between Jesus and the Jews. Now, for example, if you go to Raymond Brown, you'll find that after the introductory section, the first 10 verses, maybe the first 13 verses, Brown says, okay, here's where we can see a significant shift, because John gives you what appears to be a chronological indicator. It was about the middle of the feast, and Jesus went up to the temple. So that's what he does. He divides the rest of the material on the basis of that signal, and then the other signal in verse 37, where we're told in the last day of the feast. So Brown comes up with this very original outline. Number one, the middle of the feast. Number two, the end of the feast. And then when you go to verse 12 of chapter 8, skipping the first 11 verses, he comes up with a really powerful subheading here, miscellaneous. So it sounds as though he just gave up on this whole thing. I think it's a little bit better to look at the material the way that C.H. Dodd handles it. As I have mentioned before, you seem to have here a series of dialogues. And what he comes up with is a sevenfold division. Again, taking the first 13 verses as introductory, and then begins the actual teaching. And what Dodd tries to do is to see, is there a particular issue or theme that you can identify with each of these seven sections? And what he comes up with is verses 14 to 24, a contrast between Moses and Christ. Now you'll find that even these themes that I'm going to be mentioning are not, they're not greatly illuminating, but I do think that they get at the primary concerns of the various sections. 25 to 36, messianic claims. Now remember that each time there is some kind of interruption between these sections, and more often than not, the topic that is being dealt with in the section is in some way a response to something that the Jews have said to him. 37 to 44, not too enlightening here, but more messianic claims. Then verses 40, something's wrong, 48 to 52, there's a gap here. He makes the point that here Jesus is absent from this particular scene, and that helps you to see that once again John is operating with a like a double stage in a play. Then, skipping the first part of chapter 8, the woman taken in adultery, you have chapter 8, verses 12 to 20. The topic seems to be the value of the evidence that may be used to understand who Jesus is. Then in verses 21 to 30, Jesus is challenged. And then finally, in verses 31 to 59, Abraham, the relationship between Abraham and Christ. Now, the way that I have summarized it, it's probably not as helpful. If you read the way in which Dodd actually addresses each of these sections, it may be a little bit easier to see the rationale behind it. Now, more important than the question of exactly where do you draw the divisions and what kind of a label or summary you might give to any one of them, Dodd goes on to stress the fact that throughout this whole two-chapter section, there's a note of constant presence and urgency of the opposition. Remember, when we were talking about chapter 5, I mentioned that at that point, you have the beginnings of the opposition. And here in chapter 7 and 8, that opposition becomes more urgent. You have, you really do get the sense that there's a certain pressure that is increasing throughout the course of the material. And I believe maybe that's what's going on when you appreciate that Jesus really isn't allowed to give a discourse of any length. There are frequent interruptions. Even more to the point, throughout these two chapters, you find 10 different references to the Jews' attempts on Jesus' life. In chapter 7, the very beginning, verse 1, after these things, Jesus was walking in Galilee, for he didn't want to go walk in Judea, hoti et zeitun autan ho yudai apoptena, because the Jews were seeking to kill him. The Jews were seeking to kill him. By the way, a parenthesis on the phrase, the Jews. I've just received a copy sent to me by, what's the name? Did you get a copy of the new ABS version from this, what is the group in Philadelphia, Jewish Christian ecumenical kinds of things, remember? Anyway. The American Bible Society has come up with this new contemporary version that you've seen ads for that. But this organization is sending out free copies, very nicely bound, this and the other, because this is the first time where you have a politically correct Bible with reference to the Jews, the question of the Jews, you see. And actually, there's, you know, you can justify some of what they're getting at. Their point is that, you know, in English, the expression "the Jews" has really taken on a negative association that one might read into passages in a way that it was not intended. And so one of the things they're doing, for example, whenever they can, they use a personal pronoun instead of "the Jews" so that you don't keep repeating that word, you see. Secondly, in passages where it's contextually clear that John is alluding to just a group of Jewish leaders or whatever, then that's what you say, rather than giving the impression that you have some kind of universal attack on the Jews. It's kind of interesting, and we'll see how that develops. But anyway, so verse 1, that's the first reference to an attempt on Jesus' life. Then again in verse 13, no one was speaking openly concerning him, diaton phobon ton iudaion, because of fear of the Jews. Then verse 19, did Moses give you the law? None of you does the law. Ti mese teite apoktena, why do you seek to kill me? Here again, this combination of the verb zeitel with the verb apokteno recurs several times. That was verse 19. Then again, verse 25. Isn't this the one whom they seek to kill? The same phrase. Verse 30. Et zeiton un auton piasai. They were seeking to seize him. Verse 32. The Pharisees heard the people grumbling about these things, and they sent, and the chief priests sent, etc., hina piasos in auton, that they might seize him or arrest him. Then verse 44, the same verb piazzo, and then you have another expression there, epebalen epautantas heras, no one was, you know, laying their hands on him. Moving to chapter 8, verse 37, 8:37, alas etete me apoktena, once again, seek to kill me. Verse 40, the same expression. And finally, verse 59, they actually grabbed stones that they might throw them at him, but Jesus hid and went out of the temple. So you really can, and that alone, by the way, gives a certain sense of unity to the whole passage from chapter 7 and 8. You just can't read it without being reminded over and over again about this increased intensity in the Jewish attempt on attempts to kill Jesus. And needless to say, this kind of thematic emphasis reflects an important development in the larger plan of the gospel, which comes to a climax in chapter 12. So you need to see this section, chapter 7 and 8, as contributing in a very explicit way to an important concern of the gospel as a whole. Couple more things that I want to say of a general nature, not so much perhaps on the matter of literary structure, but trying to get a sense of the basic thrust of these two chapters. This fellow Brody, that I have called to your attention a couple of times, makes a comment that since you're dealing here with the Feast of Tabernacles, now you're moving into the fall, the autumn, and he says, the sense of the harsh environment is heightened by the fact that the action in these chapters takes place in the darker time of the year. And he also mentions, this is on page 297 of his commentary, and then he brings up that idea again in dealing with chapter 10, where you're told specifically that it was winter. Now, I can almost be persuaded in chapter 10, because you have an explicit reference, and it was winter. But I cannot help thinking that Brody here may be somewhat influenced. He's Irish, and you know, living in the higher latitudes, you might be more aware of, I don't know how. When I went to England, you don't realize how much further north it is than it is here. And it didn't even dawn on me, because I'm a little slow at these things. But finally, it was Christmas Day, and I knew something was wrong, but I couldn't tell what's wrong. But it was Christmas Day, and went to church, and it was about 11 or 11:30, and finally it dawned on me, wait a second here, it's almost noon, and it's dark. And I looked up to the sky, and the sun was just about here. You know, you expect it at 4 o'clock. And then all of a sudden it dawned on me, boy, I'm really way up north here. No wonder it's pitch black at 9 o'clock in the morning. And anyway, but you see, in Israel, it isn't that high up north, and I'm not that sure that people in Palestine would associate, you know, September, October with this dark time of the year or something like that. So I don't know what to think about it, but it might be interesting reflecting a little bit more why John makes that point of it was winter toward the end of chapter 10, and of course connection with the Feast of Dedication, not the Feast of Tabernacles. Another important element that we don't want to miss here is the significance of the theme of the ascent to Jerusalem, which you have in the Old Testament, and which becomes a very important concern in Jewish thinking more generally. You recall that important passage in Isaiah chapter 2 that becomes almost like a prototype of the eschatological expectation. Beginning with verse 2, in the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as chief among the mountains. It will be raised above the hills, and all nations will stream to it. Many peoples will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, so that we may walk in his paths. The law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will judge between the nations, and so on. And you see, when at the very beginning of this section, you have the comment on the part of Jesus' brothers, and they say, "Metabethi in Tuthin, Kaihupageist in Judaean." Go up and go from here and go to Judea, so that your disciples may see your works, and so on. And then you have, this is chapter 7, verse 3. But then, you see, when you get to verse 8, Jesus puts them off, you know, one of these passages where you wonder, what's going on here? Why does Jesus seem to be saying one thing and does another? It's in the same pattern that we saw even with the wedding of Cana, Jesus speaking to Mary. But the way that Jesus expresses himself here in the text, verse 8, you go up into the feast, ego uk anabaino esten eortain tautain. I am not anabaino. And here again, Brody makes the point that there may be a secondary reference to the ascension, and perhaps anticipating some of the other things that will come up later in the upper room discourse. You remember in chapter 20 where, we'll get to that. But is there some kind of secondary reference to the ascension, Jesus going up to the Father? I don't know. I think most commentators deny that. But Brody may have something here that, again, simply in terms of getting the reader to think about a variety of things and to anticipate themes that will be developed a little bit more explicitly as you move on. The last thing that I want to say in connection with this idea of going up to Jerusalem, Dodd, now this is toward the end of his discussion, and so now this is going to anticipate a couple of things that we still have to talk about with regard to chapter 8. But on page 351, you want to close that door, please? Well, it's let me begin to. I'm going to read a couple of paragraphs here that I think are rather useful. For John, at any rate, tabernacles is the occasion when Jesus manifests himself as Messiah in Jerusalem. His claims are canvassed in terms which show familiarity with various aspects of Jewish messianic expectation. But messianic categories are transcended when Jesus offers himself as the source of living water and as the light of the world. So the living water in chapter 7, the light of the world in chapter 8. And finally, at the end of chapter 8, when he pronounces the ego eimi, which affirms the mystery of his own eternal being in unity with the Father. This threefold manifestation corresponds with the affirmations of the prologue, which presents the Logos as the bearer of life and light, and also as being both Theos and Prostantheon. So what Dodd is telling you is, when you read the prologue and you have that initial affirmation that Jesus is life, that he was the light of the world, and that he was God, that threefold affirmation is developed and in a sense, quote-unquote, it is proven in chapter 7 and 8. When Jesus promises the water, the living water, when he calls himself the light and the life of the world, and then when he makes his reference to I am. With this in view, he goes on, the narrative setting of the dialogues takes a special significance. In chapter 7, verses 3 and 4, Jesus is urged to go up to the Feast of Tabernacles in the words, Phaneros anseoton to kosmos, manifest yourself to the world. Choosing his own time, he goes up, mesus eistes eortes, in the middle of the feast. What does this mean but a fulfillment of the prophecy of Malachi 3:1, the Lord whom you seek shall suddenly come to his temple. Now, maybe Dodd is a little bit too sure about this, but it certainly is intriguing whether this expectation of seeking, you know, people looking for you, they're seeking and so on, but then Jesus comes more or less in an unexpected way in the middle of the feast. It is the day of the Lord, which according to Zechariah 14, the Feast of Tabernacles, foreshadows. We have here a striking instance of the characteristic Johannine irony. On the surface, we are reading about a rustic prophet who leaves the obscurity of the provinces to appeal to the great public of the metropolis. On the surface. But the words, manifest yourself to the world, have a weight disproportionate to the ostensible situation. In their deeper meaning, they are an appeal to the Messiah to manifest himself to Israel. But if we go deeper still, they speak of the manifestation of the eternal Logos as life and light to the world of humankind. It follows that the narrative setting of the series of dialogues is itself a semeion, a sign, in the sense which that word bears in the fourth gospel. Now, even if you don't follow, you know, Dodd in every detail, I think you have to appreciate the force of the argument in the sense that chapter 7 and 8 really constitute a very, very important link in the whole argument of the gospel as bringing out more explicitly some of the themes already pointed out in the prologue, and as partly by the use of irony and by the use of a variety of ideas that are brought together, we'll see a little bit more of that in a minute, showing the, if you will, the cosmological significance of what it means for Jesus to go up to the temple and to the feast. Well, the second thing that I want to talk about, I mean, the second general theme here has to do with the historical background to this passage. And what I'm talking about here is the significance of the Feast of Tabernacles in a historical sense. And I think the more you know about the Feast of Tabernacles, the more you're able to get a sense for the importance of this whole passage. I might point out to you, there's an article that appeared quite a while ago by George W. McRae. Appeared in the Catholic Biblical Quarterly, volume 22 for 1960. It's entitled The Meaning and Evolution of the Feast of Tabernacles. The Meaning and Evolution of the Feast of Tabernacles, pages 251 to 76. It's one of the best summaries of the data available to us, both in terms of summarizing some of the material from the Old Testament and also the way in which the feast seemed to function within Judaism. Let me just remind you of a couple of passages in the Old Testament. In Deuteronomy chapter 31, verses 10 and 11, then Moses commanded them, at the end of every 7 years, in the year for canceling debts, during the Feast of Tabernacles, when all Israel comes to appear before the Lord your God at the place he will choose, you shall read this law before them in their hearing. Assemble the people, men, women, and children, and the aliens living in your towns, so they can listen and learn to fear the Lord your God and follow carefully all the words of this law. Their children who do not know this law must hear it and learn to fear the Lord and so on. So the public reading of the law is to take place at the Feast of Tabernacles at the end of every 7 years. And then you recall in Nehemiah chapter 8, beginning with verse 14, they found written in the law, which the Lord had commanded through Moses, that the Israelites were to live in booths during the feast of the seventh month, and that they should proclaim this word and spread it throughout their towns and in Jerusalem. Go out into the hill country and bring back branches from olive and wild olive trees and from myrtles, palms, and shade trees to make booths, as it is written. So the people went out and brought back branches and built themselves booths on their own roofs, in their courtyards, in the courts, and so on. The end of verse 17, from the days of Joshua, son of Nun, until that day, the Israelites had not celebrated it like this, and their joy was very great. Day after day, from the first day to the last, Ezra read from the book of the law of God. They celebrated the feast for 7 days, and on the eighth day, in accordance with the regulation, there was an assembly. Now, you need to appreciate that, again, thinking of the development of Judaism after the Old Testament, this rather remarkable emphasis given to the Feast of Tabernacles as the people return from exile, that is obviously going to affect in a fundamental way how the Jews about the time of Jesus would have looked at it. You're not surprised, therefore, when you read in Josephus, in Antiquities 8:4-1, Antiquities of the Jews 8:4-1, that Josephus calls it the holiest and greatest of Hebrew feasts. That's very interesting. You see, Passover, you would have thought, might have been given that description, but Feast of Tabernacles, this is really, really important. And part of the reason is that it had many different kinds of associations. One of them had to do with reminding the people about the wilderness wanderings. And of course, in the Gospel of John, you've already been prepared for that from what we have seen in chapter 6, reminding people about the manna in the wilderness and so on. The Feast of Tabernacles also associated with the role that the temple plays. In 1 Kings chapter 8, verse 2, after the building of the temple, the time when the Ark of the Covenant is brought to the temple, and all these wonderful things happen, they happen in the seventh month in connection with the Feast of Tabernacles. And of course, John has already gotten you to think about the temple, both in chapter 2 and in chapter 4. So you're prepared for that as well. Then, in addition to the wilderness wanderings, the role of the temple, and so on, you have the Feast of Tabernacles as symbolizing the expectation of blessing because of the need for rain. You know, it is a time when people begin to pray quite deliberately and intensely for the former rains, the early rains that are important in the autumn. And then you're reminded of passages in the Old Testament that stress the same idea. Zechariah chapter 10, for instance. Zechariah 10, verse 1, "Ask the Lord for rain in the springtime. It is the Lord who makes the storm clouds. He gives showers of rain to men and plants of the field to everyone." So the need to ask the Lord for rain, of course, the rains of the springtime are the latter rains, but simply the association of the Feast of Tabernacles with necessity to plead with God for the blessings of the rain. Again, here in chapter 14, verse 17, we've seen this before. "If any of the peoples of the earth do not go up to Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord Almighty, they will have no rain." And that's in connection with the Feast of Tabernacles. It has been explicitly mentioned in the previous verse. And then you remember that remarkable passage in Ezekiel chapter 47, where although here you do not have a specific reference to rain, you do have the remarkable statement about water coming down from under the south side of the temple and how the water keeps growing and growing. And the trees that are by the river and so on. So you have a significant amount of material in the Old Testament that people would associate with the need for rain. And then, of course, you have explicit eschatology. The 14th chapter of Zechariah, according to one Babylonian Babylonian Talmud, has a reference that suggests that maybe already in the first century, but we cannot be absolutely sure of this, the whole of chapter 14 of Zechariah was read on the first day of the Feast of Tabernacles, and not surprisingly. Huh? Megillah, 3a. There is a passage in Isaiah that also may be relevant here. In chapter 44, which begins with these words, "But now listen, O Jacob, my servant, Israel, whom I have chosen. This is what the Lord says, He who made you, who formed you in the womb, and who will help you. Do not be afraid, O Jacob, my servant, Jeshurun, whom I have chosen. For I will pour water on the thirsty land and streams on the dry ground. I will pour out my spirit on your offspring and my blessing on your descendants." I think we talked about that briefly before. But the significance here is that there is a scholar by the name of Gilding, and I don't have the bibliography with me, but I think Raymond Brown talks about, I think it's a woman who wrote a book discussing the, see if I remember, trying to argue that the Gospel of John reflects something about the the schedule of synagogue readings, and that she tries to connect the two, and she makes the point, as I, if I remember correctly, that this passage in Isaiah 44:3 was part of the Haftarah synagogue reading about the time of the Feast of Tabernacles. In any case, the water symbolism, as I'm sure you know, was retained very explicitly in the actual fulfillment of the feast, because the priests every day would go to the Gihon fountain, and they would chant Isaiah chapter 12, verse 3. Now remember, this information that I'm giving you comes again from the rabbinic sources, which are later, and some might dispute whether it really goes back. And Brody, in his commentary, once the way he puts it is, this is not really a problem to be solved. It is rather a rich, there's an ambiguity here, but it is not a problem. It is rather a rich microcosm of a much larger reality. Life flows out from Jesus to the believer, and from the believer, life flows out to others. And I think that's correct. Whether it is a deliberate ambiguity or not, I'm not so sure, but it's something to be kept in mind. More important than this, however, is the editorial comment that then John gives us in verse 39, where he tells us Jesus said this peritupneumatos, concerning the Spirit, whom those who believed in him were about to receive. For the Spirit was not yet, because Jesus was not yet glorified. Now, the explicitness with which John addresses this issue needs to be taken very seriously. You know, he has been teasing us all along, if you will, with ambiguous comments here and there. But now he says, I don't want to leave any doubts as to what we're talking about here. Jesus is talking about the Spirit. The Spirit was not yet given. And you need to understand, John says, that there is a necessary connection between the glorification of Jesus and the giving of the Spirit. In a sense, John cannot afford for you to miss that. And the subtlety of the earlier chapters, you might have missed it, but now you cannot miss it because it is explicit. It's an editorial comment. It's an exegetical interpretation, if you will, of Jesus' statement. And as such, that verse, to my way of thinking, really could be viewed as the key to the whole book, just about. And by the time we get to chapter 19, you know, we see a little bit more clearly just how fundamental this concern is in the development of the argument of the gospel. Now, in addition to water as an important symbol connected with the Feast of Tabernacles, you also have the symbolism of light, which shows up in chapter 8 rather than in chapter 7. According to the information that we can that we have some access to, about the time, well, in connection with the celebration of the Feast of Tabernacles, they would set up in the women's court four huge menorahs, the candlesticks. They were so big that, again, we're told that they would illuminate a large section of Jerusalem. And that is why, when you get to chapter 8 and Jesus says, I am the light of the world, you can see that you don't want to separate chapter 8 from the Feast of Tabernacles background. And I really think that's an important consideration. And by the way, I haven't said anything about the passage of the woman taken in adultery, but as you know, there are several important arguments to the view that passage is not an original part of the Gospel of John. One of them, you know, the old argument in terms of style and the language, and there's always a little bit of subjective element there and ambiguity, but you know, you can't just ignore those apparent inconsistencies in language and style. But then you have the earliest documents do not have it at all, or do not have it here. They have it somewhere else, in at the end of John or in the Gospel of Luke or whatever. But structurally, one of the main arguments is that you remember the fact that you can read verse 52 of chapter 7, and then you pick up the story in verse 12, and it makes sense in terms of the flow of the narrative. But if you keep the story of the woman where it is here, there seems to be kind of a problem. It's not a major problem, but it really doesn't seem to flow quite as well. Now, those who argue for the authenticity of this passage in John also have, you know, developed some arguments to support the view that there is a literary connection. But I don't know that they're very persuasive. More to the point, you see, and this is the thing that I wanted to get at, if you leave the story of the woman taken in adultery, you really do break this connection between the affirmation of Jesus, the light of the world, and the light symbolism in the Feast of Tabernacles. And Dodd, I think, in his discussion of this whole section, shows quite clearly that you miss something important about the whole structure of the section, chapter 7 and 8, unless you see how closely related the whole thing is to the Feast of Tabernacles background. Now, in chapter 8, verse 12, Jesus does not simply say, "Ego eimi tophos tou kosmo," I am the light of the world. But he goes on to say, "He who follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have tophos teis zoes," the light of life. And so the theme of life, which you will remember, was begun to be developed with chapter 5, now really comes into its own. And by the same token, the language about light anticipates chapter 9, the healing of the blind man. So the literary connections here are really quite rich. And it's as though nothing is really getting past John here as he's trying to link these various episodes together. Well, any comments or questions up to this point before we deal more directly with the I am question? Yeah.
You were speaking why the East and the West.
Oh, the, okay, yeah. Although occasionally you do have some manuscripts that will indicate some kind of syntactical break, and but all that would be a scribe's interpretation of it. It would not indicate a text. And this is, by the way, a little something you will want to keep in mind, because for example, when we get to the prologue, we have a similar syntactical problem of where to begin or end the sentence, and your Greek New Testament will give you some sort of manuscript evidence. And I think that could be misleading, because that's not text-critical evidence. That's just evidence of scribal interpretation. And I don't think anybody ought to get the idea that when John first wrote this, he would have, you know, put a punctuation there.
And the Scripture has said, out of the believer's heart...
It's redifact, yeah. Yeah, well, that actually, I'm not too surprised, because I am surprised. But it's not totally unheard of for somebody to take it syntactically the one way. And remember, when I talked about it, I said, if you take it in the Western way, at least it allows for taking the reference to Jesus, but it doesn't necessarily push you that way. But I do find that a little mystifying, because it is certainly not the most natural way to take the syntax. So if you don't want to preserve that explicit Christological reference, why take it this way? I don't know. I think it may be that Dodd, I don't know whether he gives you the actual... if you're really interested, Strack Bilderbeck, you know Strack Bilderbeck?
No.
It's a German commentary, which isn't so much a commentary as a, he just goes basically verse by verse, and they give whatever rabbinic references they have been able to find. But even if you can't read German, you still have the actual references to the Talmud. So that's his reference, and also Moore's book on Judaism, his work on Judaism, volume 2, apparently he gives information about that as well. All right, so let's move on then to the third major concern and what we've been moving toward, the I Am sayings, and especially the biggie, you know, at the end of chapter 8, before Abraham was, I am. What I'm going to be giving you right now depends fairly heavily on a booklet that appeared in 1970 by a fellow named Philip Harner, H-A-R-N-E-R, Philip Harner. And it is entitled The I Am of the Fourth Gospel, The I Am of the Fourth Gospel, A Study in Johannine Usage and Thought, The I Am of the Fourth Gospel. This is one of those facet books. Remember seeing those little booklets that were published back by in the 60s and 70s by Fortress Press. As I'm sure you know, the expression ego eimi has been subjected to a great deal of discussion, debate. Perhaps you're aware of the fact that Adolf Deismann, when he was doing all of his work with the papyrian inscriptions and so on, noticed many documents and sources where that expression was used. To make good sense of what's happening here, I think it's important to restrict your consideration to passages which do not have the predicate. In other words, you know, you have a whole bunch of passages in the Gospel of John where you have things like, I am the door, I am this, I am the other. You have an actual predicate. But I think it's useful to restrict ourselves to those passages where there is no predicate. And you simply have ego eimi with nothing following it syntactically. Now, when you do that, some interesting ambiguities arise. For instance, in chapter 9, verse 9, when the Pharisees are questioning the blind man, and at the end of chapter 9, ekenos elegen hoti ego eimi. So in response to the interrogation, the blind man says, ego eimi, I am, I'm the one, you know, it's me, as we would say. And you could argue that here's evidence that the expression could be used in a very ordinary way to identify yourself. It's me, you know. Somebody calls you on the phone and says, may I speak with such and such? Ego eimi, you know, that's all. Now, because you have that kind of usage, now you go back to certain other passages and you're not too sure what to do with them. Say in chapter 4, verse 26, after the Samaritan woman says, you know, we know that the Messiah will come and so on, and Jesus says, I who am speaking to you, ego eimi. Now, on the basis of chapter 9, verse 9, you might be tempted to take 4:26 in the same way. You know, I'm the one. It's me. And not see any great theological significance to it. Similarly, in chapter 6, verse 20, when you have the Jesus walking on the water, and the disciples are really scared as they see Jesus, and he tells them, "Don't be afraid. It's just me. You know, ego in me." The problem, you see, is that there are some other passages in the Gospel of John that you just can't easily dismiss as a mere self-identification without wondering whether something else is going on here. For example, right here in chapter 8, look at chapter 8, verse 24. "Therefore, I said to you that you will die in your sins, for if you do not believe, hati ego in me, you will die in your sins." Now, see, what do you do with that one? At the very least, what you have here is if you do not believe that I am the one, you know, but this cannot be a simple, if you don't know that it's me. I mean, that just doesn't make any sense. You've got to have something more there. Similarly, in verse 28, Jesus therefore said to them, "When you raise the Son of Man, then you will know hati ego in me." Same idea, you see. Or in the in chapter 13, verse 19, where Jesus says, "From now on, I tell you before it happens, so that you may believe when it happens, hati ego in me." And at that point, the NIV says that I am He with capital, the capital H. So at the very least, again, you have to view this as a messianic identification. But there's more. When you come to chapter 18, if you had any doubts about this before, you know that it's a little bit more complicated than that. This is when they come to arrest Jesus, chapter 18, verse 5, after Jesus says, "Whom are you seeking?" And they answer, "Jesus of Nazareth." And Jesus says to them, "Ego in me." Then Judas comes, the one who delivered him, so on. And then verse 6, "But when he said to them, ego in me, apelthon eistao piso kai episan kamai." When they heard him say, "I am," they fell to the ground. Now, that sounds a little bit more like than "it's me," you know. Again, once you've read that, then when you read the Gospel of John the second time, and you find chapter 4, verse 26, when he's talking to the Samaritan woman, you cannot forget the kind of impact that that expression makes. So, in the light of these considerations, we come to the biggie in chapter 8, at the end of chapter 8, "Before Abraham was, I am." And what are the implications of that? Another way of putting it is to ask the question, what is the background for the expression? And more specifically, the question, does this reflect the divine name of Yahweh? Yeh asher yeh, I am that I am. Is this what's going on here? Well, some commentators like Bultmann dispute it. And it may, in fact, not be totally correct to say that the ego in me of John 8 is a direct allusion to the self-revelation of God in Exodus. maybe not directly. However, if you look for a clear background to the to this phrase, you are inevitably, sooner or later, going to be sent back to the second part of the book of Isaiah, where the expression egoimi is in fact the Septuagint rendering of the Hebrew ani hu, I am he. I am he. And you see this fellow Harner in that booklet, this is not original with him, but I think he does a very good job of collecting the evidence and making it much more persuasive. He argues that indeed the phrase egoimi would have reminded people of this affirmation in the book of Isaiah, where God, particularly in the context of distinguishing himself from idols, you know, says, ani hu, I am the real one, I am the true God. Because even though the expression ani hu in the Hebrew might occur in a variety of contexts, the Septuagint uses the expression egoimi to translate it only where God designates himself. And the thrust of these passages consistently is one of, you know, Jehovah alone is God. He's the Lord of history. He's the Redeemer of Israel. He's the Creator of the world. Those are the contexts where you find the expression. The expression is intended to awaken faith. You see that especially, for instance, in chapter 43. Let me begin with verse 8 of chapter 43. Isaiah 43, begin with verse 8. Lead out those who have eyes but are blind, who have ears but are deaf. All the nations gather together and the peoples assemble. Which of them foretold this and proclaimed to us the former things? Let them bring in their witnesses to prove they were right, so that others may hear and say it is true. You are my witnesses. This verse 10 is the key one here. You are my witnesses, declares the Lord, and my servant whom I have chosen, so that you may know and believe me and understand that egoimi, ani hu, I am he. Before me no God was formed, nor will there be one after me. I, even I, am the Lord, and apart from me there is no Savior. Pretty powerful stuff here. The expression is related to other passages where you have the full reference to I am Yahweh. And in fact, in chapter 45, verse 18, well, let me begin earlier because you really have to remember the whole way in which the passage develops. Let me start with verse 14. This is what the Lord says. The products of Egypt and the merchandise of Cush and those tall Sabaeans, they will come over to you and will be yours. They will trudge behind you, coming over to you in chains. They will bow down before you and plead with you, saying, surely God is with you and there is no other. There is no other God. That's the key there. Truly you are a God who hides himself, a God and Savior of Israel. All the makers of idols will be put to shame and disgraced. They will go off into disgrace together. But Israel will be saved by Yahweh with an everlasting salvation. You will never be put to shame or disgraced to ages everlasting. For this is what Yahweh says, he who created the heavens, he is God. He who fashioned and made the earth, he founded it. He did not create it to be empty, but formed it to be inhabited. He says, I am Yahweh. And here the Septuagint says, egoimi, egoimi. And there is no other. I have not spoken in secret from somewhere in the land of darkness, and so on and so forth. And of course, it gets even more powerful, really, when you get to verse 22, well, verse 21, who foretold this long ago, and so on, was it not I, Yahweh, and there is no God apart from me, a righteous God and a Savior, there is none but me, turn to me and be saved, all you ends of the earth, for I am God and there is no other, and so on and so forth. So you have, you know, these exceedingly dramatic affirmations of the oneness and the exclusive oneness of God, and there, that's the kind of passage where you have the expression egoimi. Now, to say that is to also recognize that even if John 8, when Jesus says egoimi, even if you do not have a direct connection between the expression egoimi and the Exodus self-revelation of Eyeh Asher Eyeh, who can deny that the Ani Hu or the Ani Yahweh references in Isaiah 43 to 45 and so on do not build on that self-revelation of Yahweh in the wilderness? So that, at least indirectly, I find it impossible to separate the two. And then when you think specifically of the immediate context of that last statement in John 8, before Abraham was egoimi, I just do not understand how anybody can deny that you have an affirmation of self of pre-existence, but it is more than pre-existence. It is, you know, one more clear claim on the part of John that Jesus is indeed, as we saw, Yahweh, who comes back to his people, giving them food and drink, such that they will never again thirst or hunger. Now, there's several other interesting things that can be brought into the discussion. There is apparently some evidence that a variation of that phrase Ani Hu, namely Ani Vahu, Ani Vahu, was used in some context related to the Feast of Tabernacles. The Targum of Isaiah, in the passages that deal with redemption, including some of the ones that I have mentioned here, there's one too where they actually interpolate the name of Abraham, suggesting that the Jews were used to relating the role of Abraham in the context of God's redemptive purposes more generally. There are other passages. Again, you may want to go back to Dodd and see the way in which he links together a number of other references, but I think maybe this is enough for now. I hope you can appreciate that when you take the whole of this section together, chapter 7 and 8, you are really dealing with pretty much the heart of the book, the most crucial theological affirmations are being recorded here in the context of the Feast of Tabernacles. And in a way, I don't want to overstate the point here, but there is a sense in which you could see everything that has preceded chapter 7 and 8 as moving toward this section and making a number of things very explicit. And again, that redactional comment in chapter 7, verse 39 provides a key here. And what happens as you go past chapter 8 is to put the icing on the cake in some respects, drawing out some additional implications, reaffirming the themes have already been set forth, so that by the time you get to the very end of the gospel, everything really falls together into place in a rather a remarkable way. Well, questions about the I Am sayings?
Ordinary.
I don't think so. I think, you know, if they were all by themselves, they could be taken in that way. But as I said, once you read the gospel a second time, it's just impossible, at least for me, it is impossible to believe that John is not trying to get you to be thinking in terms of the kinds of associations the term has after he uses it in these other places. Yeah, I think now you go back to the predicate constructions, and again, it's very difficult not to associate them with these other things. The reason why I want to leave them aside is that there's so many examples outside of the New Testament in various kinds of religious contexts as well, where a god or somebody important might refer to a goemi such and such, that clearly by itself there's nothing extraordinary about the expression if you want to relate it particularly to the self-revelation of God in the wilderness. But yeah, I think you're right that once you have this, you go back to these other passages, and it's difficult not to bring them together. Okay, well, as you can tell from the outline, we're going to jump to Upper Room Discourse, right, for next time? No, to chapters 11 and 12. We need to see how this first half of the book comes to a conclusion. And I will say a few things about chapters 9 and 10 and 11, but the main focus is going to be the climax of this section in the latter part of chapter 12. And,